Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast from Live the Promise. There are many more podcasts available up on the website at myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible. Thank you.
For tuning in today, this is Bill Arnold in for Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise. We're here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So glad you tuned in today, and welcome to the big show on this big election day. Well, have you had a time to go out and vote yet? You know, if you're looking for where you go to vote, I think you can find out. It's probably a good chance it's designated in your voting district. Aren't I helpful today? Chances are good it's actually probably pretty close to your own house, so it doesn't take too much to go vote. You know, there was a time that people would travel up to 20 miles on horse or on foot to go vote. Now, nowadays, we wouldn't travel 20 miles without stopping twice for coffee. But back then, there was way less privacy when it came to voting. I think up until the Civil War, you simply walked into the courthouse and announced who you were voting for. Just walked in and barked it out. Usually started something like, hey, where's the bathroom? No, I don't think it said that. But you would just walk up to the table and just say who you were voting for. So we have certainly changed. And, you know, does voting make a difference? Is it important? Well, let me just point out a few one-vote wins. In 1839, I'm kind of a history buff, Marcus Morton was elected governor of Massachusetts by getting one more vote than his opponent. His new nickname was Landslide. How about that? Herbert Connolly lost track of time when he was campaigning for a seat on the Massachusetts Governor's Council in 1988 and didn't have time to vote. He lost his own election by one vote. Ha! Huh. In Sidney Nixon's case, one vote mattered twice. He won his election for Vermont State Representative by one vote. Then they recounted the votes, and he had lost by one vote. Ouch! So it's important to get out and vote. It's our it's something we get to do as citizens of this great country, and it is a great country. So I hope I hope everyone goes and does that today. Now, the question I want to ask today is, are all religions basically the same? There's the burning question. Our guest today is Jared Wilson. He's written a book called Unparalleled, How Christianity's Uniqueness Makes It Compelling. And Jared is the director of content strategy for Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and managing editor of For the Church, Midwestern's new site for gospel-centered resources. He's the author of many books, including Your Jesus is Too Safe, The Storytelling God, The Prodigal Church, and Gospel Wakefulness. His blog, The Gospel-Driven Church, is hosted by the Gospel Coalition, and he speaks at numerous churches and conferences throughout the year. He lives in KC. Jared, welcome to the big show.
Bill, thanks so much for having me.
You know, this question comes up all the time because we're getting to the point where are all religions the same? And what is your instant response to that?
Well, of course, the answer is no. You know, what's really fascinating is while, you know, people in the wider culture have been making this claim for quite some time that Christianity is just sort of one option among many, you know, all paths lead to the same place, that sort of thing. We're actually starting to see in more of the research year by year that there's actually more professing evangelicals who are starting to, you know, agree with that claim. It's not a majority by any stretch, but mm-hmm. It's a little distressing that we're actually seeing people who identify as Christian, you know, basically believe in the same thing, that all religions are basically the same.
That's stunning to me. I just can't believe that. And we're getting more and more people who are saying, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, we have sort of a parallel for that, I think, in the church. You know, it's been a long time cliche in evangelicalism, you know, that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's a sense in which that's, you know, very much true, obviously. You know, Christianity is founded on united to Christ and abiding in Christ. It's not about just a rote, you know, dutiful, you know, following of the, you know, checklist. But, you know, in the wider world, whenever you begin to sort of have these sort of spiritual conversations with people, you know, want to talk about the gospel, it's one of the cliches that the world uses in essentially trying to say they're not an adherent or a fan of organized religion, but they have some sort of vague sense of spirituality. They believe that there is a depth to the universe or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jared, I'm curious to get to know you just a little bit and let our listeners find out about your personal faith journey. Can you kind of give us your elevator pitch on that?
Sure. Grew up in the church, Baptist church. Have believed for as long as I can remember. But grew up in the Bible Belt and sort of discipled within the Christian culture of the South for a very long time. Believed that the Lord was calling me into ministry. Even when I was an adolescent, I was in junior high at a youth camp. Doing a devotion, basically reading about God's call of Moses, and the Lord really used that to kind of stir my heart and pursue more this idea of, serving the church with my life. And so I started out in ministry, in vocational ministry, the year I graduated high school, and spent about 20 years serving in a variety of churches, worked in student ministry. I planted a church, also pastored a church in Vermont for about 6 years, so left the Bible Belt for the Northeast. And up until about 2 years ago, I was there in Vermont, where eventually moved to Kansas City, Missouri. Now I work at Midwestern Seminary. And so pursuing ministry for me now is not just, helping the seminary kind of train men and women for ministry, but, doing writing and speaking and trying to help as many people who will let me people look to Jesus Christ and mm-hmm. His glory as a solution for life.
Yeah. As a speaker and a writer and a guy who meditates on Scripture a lot, tell me a verse or a passage that God has just absolutely hit you between the eyes with lately.
Yeah, I think for the last probably 2-3 years, actually, my sort of theme verse for ministry is 1 Corinthians 2:2, where Paul says, I resolve to know nothing among you except Christ and Him crucified.
Mm.
To me, just the essence of Christianity, but also of Christian ministry, that Paul would say, there's a lot of things that I know a lot about, and there's a lot of things that are important, but for me, my sole vision, my sole focus is that gospel message that Jesus Christ died to forgive sins. That for me has been my theme and sort of the driving focus for me in centering on the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you talk about a conversation you had with a cab driver, which I found fascinating because we're, as Christians, often a little over-anxious to just tell people what we think versus getting into their story and listening to them and kind of giving them their voice. Can you tell us a little bit about that conversation?
Sure. There's a couple of stories, actually, of sharing the gospel with cab drivers in the book. The first one, I was in Washington, D.C., I believe, and was with a friend of mine, and began talking to the driver about, religion and spiritual things. And one thing I've learned just over the last few years, sharing the gospel, usually with cab drivers or Uber drivers,
mm-hmm.
Those who subscribe to Islam in some way, those who identify as Muslim, and this particular fellow was what I might call a nominal Muslim. He said he believed in the Islamic faith, but he wasn't practicing. He hadn't, followed the religion in a while. But they're very eager, actually, to talk about religion. They don't have any hang-ups about talking about spiritual things, and they're actually quite easy. I know I'm generalizing here, but Muslims are quite easy to share the gospel with because they don't have the same sort of hang-ups that a lot of, just sort of culturally American, even irreligious people have about, you don't talk about religion in polite society,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. So this fellow was pretty eager to talk about, the Bible and different things like that. And what I recall is, the story that I tell in the book is he had a high view of holiness. His view of God, Allah, was holy. And so he said that Allah would not forgive murder
mm-hmm.
because you could make no restitution for that. And so on one level, I was sort of impressed that he had this high view of holiness where, God, that murder was a significant sin. But at the same time, I wanted him to know that, the real God has a message of grace and sent his son to die to forgive any sin that we could repent of. So I just found it fascinating that he had this high view of holiness, but just could not fathom the idea that God would himself satisfy that, demand for holiness in the gift of his son.
Mm-hmm. He said in the book that, if I steal something from you, I have an opportunity to make good on that. I can provide some kind of restitution. But if I murder you, there's no way I can do that, and therefore God would never forgive me. And then you asked him about some of the people that sacrificed their life, jihadists, and, if they're murdering, are they then going right to heaven? And his opinion was no.
Yeah. I think it sort of reveals, the legalistic base, or just the legal base, I guess we should say, of, the Islamic faith and really any religion outside of Christianity. For him, God's forgiveness was tied to our ability to, to make restitution.
Mm-hmm.
And so his logic was saying, if I kill someone, I can't bring that person back. I can't make restitution for that. And so God would not, forgive it. But if I steal from you, I can pay you back or make restitution some other way. And, God would then be able to forgive me. So, in his mind, in his, interpretation of the Islamic faith, is very legalistic. So if we are able to make restitution ourselves, then we are earning God's forgiveness of us.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is completely antithetical to the message of the gospel.
Oh, entirely. It's a very performance-based theology. We are starting off as young kids being praised for, a lot of things that we do, and then we get little trophies and we're told we're good, and then, by the time we get to be adults, we think that the program is, if I perform well and if I'm a good person and there's a good God and a good heaven, I've scored some kind of points with him, right?
That's right, yeah.
We're going to pick that up when we come back. We're going to take a little break. We've got having a great conversation started with Jared Wilson about his book, Unparalleled, How Christianity's Uniqueness Makes It Compelling. We're going to take a short break. Be right back. You're listening to Live the Promise. Bill Arnold in for Susie. Be back in a minute. Christianity's uniqueness compelling. How are we doing in that department? Are we loving people? Are we loving God, loving others? I'm not so sure I'm doing very good at that. I tell you, I've been pretty irritable lately, so I got to have an attitude adjustment here, Jared. I'm talking to Jared Wilson. He's written the book called Unparalleled. And Jared, I want to know, what is the common idea of God that everyone seems to agree upon?
I think, generally speaking, the idea that everyone has a God is that he's higher than us. He is other, that sort of thing. But I think most people who believe in a God, if you were to ask people who don't believe in a God, what their conception of a Christian God is, they probably would say judging, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone who believes in a God, even if they're not Christians and they don't believe in the true God, I think in general they would say that God is a God of love of some kind, that he, has a fatherly care for his creatures and, that sort of thing. But of course, it's only in Christianity that we see what God as love actually means and,
right.
And actually see real love manifested for creation in the sending of God's Son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did the love cost?
Hmm.
What is the most common objection to Christianity? Because as we're trying to go out and be light and salt in the world, and we're trying to show the love of Christ to people, we should be attracting people to us. But I think I'm repelling. So what's the most common objection to Christianity?
Yeah, well, I think the most common objection is when you alluded to earlier, is just simply that Christianity is just one expression of many truths. That Christianity is just sort of one doorway. For people who reject all religion, they would simply say all religions are the same, and people are just Christians because they grew up that way or grew up in a place where Christianity was dominant, that sort of thing. For those who do subscribe to some kind of religion that's not Christianity, they might say Christianity has some valid truth to it, but again, it's really just sort of one path, that leads to, to this vague idea of God, to a generalized, to a generalized God.
Mm-hmm.
What's really fascinating, I think, for those who really know what Christianity teaches, is that if you lay, Christianity out with every other religion in the world and every other philosophy, whether it's religious or irreligious, only in Christianity do you find this message of grace. The idea that God would forgive our sins and save us as a pure gift,
mm-hmm.
not based on anything we've done, not on our performance, on our works, not even on our good intentions, but purely as an act of grace. You don't find that in any other religion. To me, that's what makes Christianity the most compelling. It's just how unique it is. I don't think we would have made that up, honestly.
No.
It's one of the, it's one of the messages that commends Christianity to me, at least, because it makes so little of us. Grace, the message of grace basically, presumes that we can't measure up. And so, of course, other religions would seem appealing to people who want to be made much of, who want some of that glory for themselves.
Mm-hmm. When I have conversations with people, one of the objections that I hear often is this: how can you talk about the sin stuff? Sin sounds like such an awful word. I'm a pretty good person, for crying out loud. I give to the United Way. I shovel my neighbor's walk. I do good stuff. So how am I a sinner? And obviously it's the job of the Holy Spirit to convict a person that they recognize and see their need for repentance. How does your book Unparalleled help bring clarity to some of these misunderstandings that we talk about?
Yeah, when someone, says those things, and it's quite common, what they're demonstrating is really the default state of people who don't know the gospel, and really people who do when they're not centered on the gospel. Because we all sort of play with this idea of scales, of measurement. And even Christians sometimes measure their own conviction based on how much better they're doing than someone else, or even how much better they're doing than themselves previously, that sort of thing. It's very easy to sort of, conflate our own performance with our standing with God and forget that our justification is received by faith. Our salvation is by grace alone apart from works.
Mm-hmm.
And so when someone says something like that, hey, I'm a good person, I do good deeds and that sort of thing, basically what they're doing is bringing out that measurement. And all the Christian needs to do is sort of say, okay, well, compared to what? Compared to whom? Because if you're comparing yourself to, for instance, Adolf Hitler or Jeffrey Dahmer, a lot of people, most people that we know, if not everybody that we know, looks pretty good, actually, compared to that measurement. But once you've set up that scale, you're already acknowledging that there's some people who are really bad, really simple.
Mm-hmm.
And even people who don't believe, irreligious people, they don't believe in a God, they don't believe in a heaven or a hell. Those people would admit if there was a hell, someone like Adolf Hitler should be there,
mm-hmm.
or Jeffrey Dahmer should be there.
Yeah.
And once you're able to get them to admit that, they're already admitting that there is such a thing as right and wrong. Everyone has an innate sense of justice. If you were to steal something from them, they would feel wronged somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so all we have to do is ask them, where does that come from? Where would you get that idea if there really wasn't a God and there really wasn't a standard and there really wasn't holiness? And once you kind of go down that track and start talking about, okay, this sense of right and wrong comes from somewhere, it's not too far before the Christian can begin to talk about the one true God who has a holy standard. And if he is the standard of holiness, then none of us measure up. Because no matter how many good works we do, we could never compare to the holiness of God himself.
Mm-hmm. Jared, I loved your story of just you being a sophomore in high school at the lunch table. That to me, I love that because I'm always very nostalgic about some high school experiences, and this is a cute one. Would you share it with our listeners?
Sure. You know, what I really enjoyed about my high school experience at the lunch table, and I didn't enjoy very much about it, to be honest with you. I was kind of the, you know, keep your head down, just try not to get noticed kid uh-huh. in high school. But I sat at a table with, you know, four or five guys who were not like me in a lot of superficial ways, but were a lot like me in ways that mattered. So, you know, my best friend in high school, this guy named Eric, an Hispanic guy. So I sat at a table with Eric, who is Hispanic. We had a friend named Charles, who's African-American. We had a friend named Babar, who's from the Middle East, and a couple other guys. And so we looked like this little, you know, rainbow coalition. It was just all different colors uh-huh. sitting at the table. But the one thing we had in common was that none of us really fit in with our own kind of tribes or people groups. And so, you know, we weren't necessarily outcasts. I wouldn't, you know, characterize us that way. We weren't picked on or anything. But we just didn't really fit in anywhere except with each other. And to me, it was just a great picture, even though, you know, we weren't all Christians, you know, but we could talk about those sorts of things, mainly because we had in common, you know, just a curiosity about life. And also just this idea that we belong together somehow at this lunch table.
Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that story touched me so much, Jared, was because we live in such an incredibly polarized world right now. I mean, mm-hmm. you bring up one thing that doesn't fit with the people at the table's agenda, and all of a sudden you're like outcast. And I love the fact that a bunch of kids that kind of were semi-misfits all found each other and loved each other and got along together and did life together.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there was something about our shared humanity that was greater than even sometimes individual experience, but certainly, you know, agendas and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, my friend Eric and I were probably the only, you know, believers at that table, the only Christians at that table. But we had a hearing with those folks, mainly because our agenda wasn't to force our religion on them. We talked freely mm-hmm. about our faith and going to church and that sort of thing. But they knew that we actually cared about them and that we were actually friends, and that if they rejected our Jesus, we weren't going to stop being their friend. And so I think that actually gained a hearing with them and maybe planted some seeds for them, you know, for the gospel.
Yeah, we have 1 minute before we have to go to a hard break. But obviously this points out our obvious need for community. And how does Christianity answer that need? How does Christianity talk about that?
Yeah, obviously... you know, there's a big subject in that the Trinity itself, I think the doctrine of the Trinity corresponds to our need for community. We're made to be in relationship because we're made in the image of God, who is himself triune and in relationship. But we also have that the gospel doesn't just reconcile us individually to God, but creates a family. The gospel makes the church with Jesus Christ as our bridegroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's probably the primary way, I think.
Yeah.
Good news of that, Christianity.
Of course, that music would say we got to go to break. So, Jared, we're going to take a little break. We come back lots more with Jared Wilson, his book Unparalleled, How Christianity's Uniqueness Makes It Compelling. You're listening to Live the Promise. Bill Arnold in for Susie. We'll be right back. Religions basically the same. We know that not to be true. We're talking to Jared Wilson. He's written a book called Unparalleled, How Christianity's Uniqueness Makes It Compelling. We've got a couple copies to give away, so if you want to enter the drawing, email Aaron at MyFaithRadio, A-A-R-O-N at MyFaithRadio.com, and put Unparalleled in the subject line. Make sure you put your name and address, because if you win, we're going to want to know where to send it. Aaron, when you talk about mirrors, are always the first thing one thinks of when it comes to religion. But can you describe some mirrors that help reveal the truth of Christianity and talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I use the image of the mirror in the book. First of all, sacred mirrors, and then secondly, broken mirrors. Sacred mirrors because the Bible teaches that man and woman are made in the image of God. And so in some really important and helpful ways, we're to see ourselves as reflecting the glory of God. Now, obviously, we're not gods ourselves or divine in that sense, but there's something about the way God has made us to reflect his glory, whether that has to do with our consciousness being higher than the animals, that sort of thing, having souls, relationality. We relate in ways that, of course, animals don't. But even just sort of creativity, the way that we create, you know, that sort of thing. So we're made in the image of God, therefore we're sacred mirrors. I think this helps us, especially when it comes to, you know, just things going on in the world constantly, you know, that tend to divide us and polarize us and tempt us to treat each other with suspicion and derision and anger, to remember that all people are made in God's image and therefore sacred mirrors, you know, reflecting the glory of God. But at the same time, we have to be really realistic, right? That's the optimistic view of humanity. Every, you know, man and woman is you know, sacred from conception. We have great potential because of the creativity and the intelligence and the glory that God has, you know, given us and shared with us. But we're also, because of the fall, because of the, you know, original sin, we're broken mirrors. So we don't reflect the image of God as perfectly as Adam and Eve did before the fall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sin is embedded in us, so all of our pursuits will be tainted in some way by this. And so it's actually very realistic. And so I think Christianity brings great balance and understanding to the way we look at humanity, because most people tend on one polar opposite or the other. Some people, they, you know, sort of elevate humanity to almost godlike status. We're the creators of our own destiny, and we have such great potential. And we've seen, you know, just in some forms of government and, you know, utopian sort of experiments and that sort of thing, how people sort of, you know, elevate man, you know, above where they should. But then we also have people who are very, you know, they denigrate mankind and treat, you know, men and women as disposable. And we certainly see this in abortion culture and infanticide and human trafficking and just all sorts of injustice. But Christianity comes along and makes sense of both of these polar opposite reactions to say we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and yet we were conceived in sin. We do have, you know, this brokenness inside of us. And so Christianity is both at the same time, optimistic, but also realistic about humanity.
Mm-hmm. You know, as we engage in our culture, in our neighborhoods, and we talk to people about their religious upbringing, you said something in the book that I think I've used myself, and maybe it's now common knowledge that people talk this way, but I've always been interested in finding out, tell me about the God that you have rejected. You know, give me an understanding about this God that you had to, that you wanted no part of at all, because we usually end up with conversations that go into like, well, I could just never worship a God who sends people to hell. And I bet a lot of listeners have heard that before. What is your response to that?
Well, you know, just to the idea that they couldn't worship a God who would send someone to hell, I think we go back to that issue of justice. So we say, could you imagine worshiping a God who sends really bad people to hell, like Adolf Hitler and that sort of thing? And most people would say, yes, they can imagine that, because they would acknowledge that there's a special category of people who are really, really, really evil. Mm-hmm. And if there is a hell, some people deserve to go there. Well, now they've opened the door to a standard. And now we need to talk about, okay, well, now you admit there is a standard. Let's talk about what that standard is and where that standard comes from. But it's also, you know, we don't stop there. The Christian doesn't just speak of hell and judgment and condemnation. We have the good news. And so we say, look, we do believe in and worship a God who does send people to hell. But this same God is actually a God of love and provides the escape. And so if anyone would repent of their sin and believe in Jesus Christ, they would escape that hell. The same God who condemns sinners also forgives them.
Mm.
If they would put their faith in his son, Jesus Christ. And so once you kind of, you know, bring that into play, I think it gives, you know, I mean, obviously it gives the truth about God,
mm-hmm.
but it also, I think, allows people to have a better perspective of the kind of God that we believe in.
Mm-hmm. Jared, I'm going to ask you this. How about this one? How about, I could believe in God, but only if he held to some of my ideas and values. That's fair. That's fair, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's sort of like, I forgot who said it, but, you know, God made man in his image, and all, and ever since we've been trying to return the favor.
Right, right.
Yeah, you know, what good, you know, essentially someone who says that is basically saying that they worship themselves. You know, the God who only shares my values and my perspectives.
How
puny a God would that be, right?
Well, but when they drag out this line, I know my God, and my God wouldn't fill in the blank.
You know, depending on what's in that blank, maybe he wouldn't do that. But, you know, it's, you know, these are always great sort of opportunities to kind of go to the, you know, to the scriptures, you know, and show them actually the revelation of the one true God and what he would or would not do. But, you know, to me, if God always fit neatly into our box, if God always did what I expected of him, if God always agreed with me, then he wouldn't really be God, I don't think. And wouldn't be worthy of my worship if he was something or someone easily manageable, somebody that I could very easily understand. That to me wouldn't commend, you know, the adoration and awe, you know, that the one true God actually deserves.
A mind outside this world created this world.
That's right. That's right.
Jared, what does evil look like?
Oh, gosh. You know, in that section of the book, I essentially talk about original sin and the depravity that's embedded in all of us. And I use the, you know, the instance of the Boston Marathon bombing. And I remember in sort of the, you know, the hours, days sort of coming out of that attack. And it was really interesting, especially on social media, to hear everybody's theories. And I think we see this too every time there's another kind of terrorist attack or, if, you know, something, a shooting or something like that. Everyone has their sort of standard idea of who would do such a thing. And, you know, begin to kind of throw out these sort of, you know, different theories. And what was really sort of morbid, I think, is there almost seemed like there are people who are rooting for certain kinds of people because they had already decided that certain kinds of people would do such a thing. And what was really fascinating is the, you know, of course, the Boston Marathon bombers, they fit into some of our categories, but not totally, right? So they were Muslim. So, you know, it was Islamic terrorism in that sense. But the picture that we had of what that would look like, right, the 9/11 bombers, you know, that sort of thing, we pictured this, you know, or some people picture kind of the dark-skinned, Middle Eastern-looking. And these two brothers come from the Caucasus region, you know, which is where we get the word Caucasian from. The younger brother especially was a college student who all of his friends, when they were interviewed, said they couldn't imagine, you know, that he would have done such a thing because he was such a, you know, laid-back guy. He played ping pong and all this sort of thing, smoked marijuana with everybody. And, you know, like, you know, in their mind, someone who would, you know, bomb someone just looks so obviously evil. I don't know if they're picturing the kind of cartoonish guy kind of twirling his mustache or something. But I think, you know, what helped us see, and it happens every time, you know, they, you know, the police arrest someone, you know, a serial killer or something, and you hear the neighbor say, oh, he was such a quiet man or something.
Right.
It's just a reminder that evil looks like us. It looks like the face in the mirror, all of us, whether, you know, we're capable of these great atrocities or not, are still quite capable of violating the law of God because of the sin that's in us.
Mm-hmm. Jared, is the gospel full of coincidences?
It depends on how you define coincidence. I would say no. You know, what's really fascinating about the way the New Testament sort of recasts the historical narratives of the Old Testament, it's how we begin to see these little foretastes and foreshadows, you know, take fuller shape. Mm-hmm. I like to think of the Old Testament almost like a darkened living room, right? You kind of walk into this room and it's dark. And you can kind of make out the shape of furniture, but you can't quite tell what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all there, and you can feel your way around it and make good guesses. But then when the New Testament comes, the light of Christ comes, it's like the lights come on. And it's in that moment where Jesus is on the road to Emmaus with his disciples, and, you know, he's walking along with them. And it says he revealed to them everything about himself from the law and the prophets. And to me, it's just one of those moments where he's connecting the dots for them, showing that all of these prophecies, all of these instances of what we might call coincidence or happenstance, really were divinely foreordained, that God planned them all, and planned them all, of course, to lead into the culmination of the revelation of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. We look at Jesus and we see how radical he is of a teacher, and you can see how magnetic he could be, but you could also see him being offensive to people in how he spoke.
Yeah, you know, that's sort of the polarity of the gospel itself. You know, Paul talks about that. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Well, certainly Jesus embodied this, because as he goes around, foretelling the cross, but also just sort of putting himself at the center of everything, saying that he is the way, the truth, and the life, that he and the Father are one, that no one's getting to the Father except through him, that if you want to live in John chapter 6, you have to eat his flesh and drink his blood.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who find this incredibly compelling, and it tends to be people who are needy and have a very palpable sense of their own, desperation and need for God. But there are also people who find it very offensive, and those tend to be those who like their own righteousness, self-righteous people. And what you don't find, what you rarely find, are people who are kind of apathetic about Jesus. Either people are attracted to him or they're repelled from him. And people who are, seem ambivalent, he would even say, you're actually antagonistic. If you're not with me, you're actually against me. You may feel like you could take or leave me, but really you're leaving me if you feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the difference between the exclusive gospel offer of Christianity and what some other religions are saying.
Other religions may come along and put themselves into competition with each other and sort of just lay themselves out as sort of an option. Christianity comes along and says, look, you only receive Jesus Christ as he truly is in Christianity. Other religions may lay claim to Jesus. He's a good teacher. He's one of our prophets, that sort of thing. Only Christianity comes along and says, look, Jesus Christ is, the name above all names. He's the only name under heaven by which we may be saved. Every knee is going to bow. Every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So the exclusivity of Christianity is really the exclusivity of Jesus. You can't sort of have one piece of him and think that's good enough. You can't just sort of take Jesus as a guru or some sort of sage. You really do have to believe that he is God incarnate, that he really is the Lord of the universe, that he really is king. Even to have his salvation means to surrender to his lordship. And so Christianity stands alone, unparalleled, partly because of that, because Christianity is the only religion that really has Christ in it.
Right. But there's still a lot of people that want to go through the spiritual salad bar, and that would include a lot of Christians. I'll take a little of this.
That's right.
I'll have some of that. Yeah,
but
I don't want that. And unfortunately, that's not the way it works. We're either all in, because God exchanges his life for ours, and you don't add him onto the resume, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, all right. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to have one more segment with Jared Wilson, his wonderful book, Unparalleled, How Christianity's Uniqueness Makes It Compelling. You're listening to Live the Promise. Bill Arnold in for Susie Larson. We'll be right back. Subject today, how Christianity's uniqueness makes it compelling. And we're talking to Jared Wilson, who's written a great, great book called Unparalleled. And Jared, I'm curious as to what do you think is the most incredible idea in the history of the universe? How about that for a loaded question?
Yeah, I really loved that concept of a title, and I hoped it would draw people in. I think the most incredible idea in the history of the universe is that idea of grace, the message of grace, that we could be loved unconditionally, accepted, approved, forgiven, justified by the holiest being there is, by God himself, the creator and sovereign Lord of the universe. Just the idea that the only one who deserves to condemn us is actually the only one who can make us righteous and will through the work of his son.
Mm-hmm.
I just find that so mind-blowing, so amazing. To me, as I said earlier, we would not have made that up.
Mm-hmm.
All of us sort of have this default moralism to us, or legalism to us, this merit system. We want, approval of our deeds and of our works, and we tend to treat other people based on their deeds and on their works, what they've done for us or what they haven't done for us. And that, because of that, if we were to invent a religion, in fact, every other religion but Christianity has at its foundation a sort of legal framework. You don't find the message of grace anywhere but in Christianity, which to me, commends it as true.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in every other religion and philosophy in the world, man is trying to earn his way to heaven, to enlightenment, nirvana, a fellowship with God, whatever it is. Only in Christianity does God say, I give this to you as a free gift. I send my son to die on the cross and rise again so that if anyone would believe in him, he would be saved. You only find that message of grace in Christianity. And that's why I argue in the book, if our messages, if our witness, if our preaching and teaching, if our lifestyles don't commend that message, the message of grace, we've actually lost Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Because people can get law anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other religion that you can speak of that has the transforming power that we see in Christians who are born again? I mean, I see some pretty cheerful people out there who seem to have a lot of things going for them, that they look pretty good, a lot of personal fulfillment and focus and motivation and kindness and love and generosity. Anything else out there?
Yeah, I think you find, obviously, common grace. There's a sense in which God has blessed us all with common grace, revealed